Hey, hey, hey.
What's up, Asymmetry? Hello, everybody. Super duper pleased to have gotten to sit down with Laura Buchan tonight, a phenomenal sculptor from the Gorge in Washington. And I've been following Laura's work on Instagram, Laura Buchan Sculpture, and have watched her just in the past 12 to 18 months and seen a lot of what she produces and been very inspired by her work. And serendipity prevailed, and we were able to get Laura to Mirai to share her thoughts on her sculptural process, her evolution as an artist, and just sort of the general background that led her to creating such organic forms in the way and with the skill and craftsmanship that she pursues. And it was a wonderful conversation. She's an incredible person to hang out with, and getting to enjoy her work firsthand was really quite an experience. So we hope you enjoy, and check out her work if you can on Instagram or laurabuchan.com and see what she's up to, because it truly is stunning. All pretty tight.
Yeah.
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 And are they still in Dallas, Oregon?
No. My sister's in Portland and she's married. And then my youngest brother just graduated from grad school for physical therapy.
Okay.
In Portland, Maine. Mm. So I'm going out next month for his graduation.
Have you been there yet?
No.
I heard Maine is awesome.
I've heard that too.
And yeah. I heard Portland, Maine is particularly awesome. Are you super discriminating in what you find to be attractive and well-made, being such like a artist yourself?
I mean, everybody likes what they like, right? So
sure.
But you know, for myself, yeah, I'm discriminating, but I can look at something and appreciate the craftsmanship that goes into it without wanting to live with it, or
yeah,
you know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's super cool to see your pieces in person, because I've been following you for been following your work for probably like a year and a half now.
Okay. How did you find me originally?
So my recollection is not very clear on how I found you.
Okay.
But I think that OMF Geco or one of the design studios in Portland posted something. No, you know what it was? You put an installation in Skylab Architecture.
Oh, yeah.
In their window.
Yeah.
And I had like seen your work already, and then I saw like the Nautilus pieces that you hung mm-hmm. in their in that quasi Burnside location.
Yeah.
And I was like, ah, that's dope.
That's
super beautiful, super architectural. We have a relationship with Skylab. They designed an exhibition that we held at the Portland Art Museum in 2015. So
cool.
I really, really like Jeff Covell and his work, and his team's work is super awesome.
Yeah. Did you have a bonsai tree in their window for a while?
I did, for almost a year and a half.
Okay.
Yeah. We changed it out every week. It was a monstrous project.
I remember seeing that.
Do you?
Yeah.
Really? Oh, cool.
Yeah, that's very cool. I was, when I was out there in the garden, I kept thinking, okay, it must have been you that did the trees in that window, but I couldn't think of the name of the architecture firm.
Yeah.
Right in that moment.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, because Daniel Myers was the lead architect on the Artisans Cup exhibition that we did. So I worked really closely with Daniel to design the structures that we used in the museum. And then Tracy Sim, his partner, did all of the experiential design, and she also handled the sort of the execution of the artists that they brought in to do the displays in their location. So yeah, Tracy and Daniel are rad. They were super cool.
Nice.
Yeah. And then we did an installation in their space with Jeff's sister, who does Esque Glass.
Yeah, Glass, right?
Yeah. Her and her partner, Andy.
Yeah.
Who are also like outstanding to work with. So they did some really cool pieces that sort of integrated with the trees.
Yeah, I remember seeing that. It was really beautiful.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Oh, nice. Yeah. Very cool. I'm very flattered that you have seen our work.
Well, yeah. Likewise.
Yeah. So like I saw that, and then you I started following you on Instagram, and I saw you were included in the contemporary, the magazine of contemporary master woodworkers or something like that.
Oh yeah. The Wood Symphony Gallery.
Yeah, I just, it's like kind of brown and it has one of your pieces. I just remember like the design piece.
Yeah.
And I read, you know, I read like, you wrote a description about sort of your approach to your woodworking where it's like a discussion of things that could be, things that are disappearing that we maybe have forgotten or haven't even gotten to experience yet.
Right, yeah.
And I, that just took me way deeper into appreciating your work because it was like, oh, this is really somebody thinking about their sculpture on a level that's raising awareness.
Yeah.
Sort of the medium that you've chosen and the subjects that you've chosen to sculpt.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of compatible with like why I do bonsai and sort of what we're trying to accomplish here.
Right.
Because I think we do have a significant relationship with the natural environment that is very easily forgotten, particularly in the modern era of technology.
Yeah, absolutely.
And like those touch points that remind us of that.
Yeah.
I think are more significant now than ever before.
Yeah.
So I was like, someday I'm going to meet Laura and have a piece of her work.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
You can actually call me LB.
LB?
Yeah, I go by LB in the gallery world. I use my full name so that it matches the name on the wall.
Right.
But yeah, in life, everyone calls me LB.
LB. Cool. Yeah. How do you say your name appropriately?
My last name?
Yeah.
Buchan.
Buchan.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I always say it rhymes with you can.
You can.
Yeah,
you can.
That's how you can remember it.
What is your ancestry?
Our name is Scottish.
It is.
Yeah.
Cool.
I don't think it was originally pronounced Buchan. I think it was Buchan or I don't know something
right.
else. Yeah, and then that's on my dad's side.
Cool.
And then German on my mom's side mostly. Wow.
I'm Scottish German as well.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. We took like a family trip with my grandma and my family. I have an older sister.
Mm-hmm.
And we flew into London and then we took the train up to Edinburgh. And then we drove all the way back down to Dover through all of England over like 2 weeks. It was pretty intense.
Wow.
To be, in the car with my family for that long. But like the whole goal was like trying to like go to the places where our ancestors came from and also
experience. Oh, that's very cool.
Yeah, kind of. It was. Yeah, there were moments.
Yeah, there's always moments
right.
with family.
Right. It was. Yeah, there were some high points for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you ever been to Scotland?
No, I have traveled very little outside the U.S.
Ah.
Yeah. Canada and Mexico.
How did you... So, okay. First of all, so you were born in Calabasas.
Mm-hmm.
And then your family moved to Dallas, Oregon?
No, we moved to Minnesota.
Okay.
My sister was born there, and we were there maybe a year, not very long.
Do you remember Minnesota?
I remember snow being like as tall as me. I was like 3.
Right.
And I remember the summers were really, really hot.
Yeah.
And other than that, it's very vague. It was like soybean fields. And then we moved to Montana, and we lived in a little town called Laurel outside Billings.
Mm-hmm.
And then we moved outside Bozeman. We were closer to Belgrade, but our address was Bozeman. We were about 15 miles out of Bozeman. And
how long were you in Montana?
So probably from 3 to 12. So
okay. So
4 to 12.
Kind of like formidable years too.
Yeah. So, I mean, it feel like when people ask where I'm from, I say I'm from Montana and I say I grew up outside Bozeman. Cause that feels like home.
Yeah.
Even though I never go back.
But, yeah. You know,
but yeah.
Yeah. And then, so at 12, you moved to Oregon.
Yeah. So my oldest brother was profoundly deaf. He went deaf before I was born. So I just grew up with sign language as a second language. And, you know, most states only have one deaf school for the whole state. And so he was just really isolated. We lived in he basically only had us, you know. So my mom started doing research and my parents traveled and visited a couple different states and settled on Oregon. So
cool.
Yeah. So he went to Oregon School for the Deaf in Salem.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So that's what brought us out here.
You still have a Salem phone number.
Yeah.
And it all makes sense.
Yeah.
It's like, Salem, who do I know from Salem? And then you're like, I'm here. I'm at a vacant lot. I was like, all right. She got there.
Yeah, I was very confused.
Yeah.
I was like, is it this blue house? That doesn't look right.
Right. Yeah.
I'm not seeing trees right. that I think I should be seeing here.
right. Like, yeah. I've got a few on my back porch, and I'm like, I'm a bonsai artist. Yeah. And you're like, oh my gosh, what did I just commit to? Right.
Yeah, I wasn't sure, but
right. How amazing would that be if I was like, this is my bonsai collection of like three little tiny trees?
I would still be impressed because I don't know anything about it. I'd be like, there you go. Like, these are lovely.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So how did you get from Salem basically to where you're at now in Stevenson?
So I went to college at Western Oregon University. Which is only like 6 miles from Dallas. And I landed there because they had a really good American Sign Language interpreting program.
Mm-hmm.
And that was what I thought I was going to do with my life.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's a liberal arts college. So I was taking art to fulfill just basic core requirements. And I kind of fell in love with art. And I changed my major. And then I was trying everything, and I had this really like romantic idea of the artist as a painter, like mm-hmm. most people do.
Sure.
So I was painting, and I was doing a bunch of stuff. I was printmaking. I was in photography at one point, and I took a drawing systems class from the sculpture professor, and he spent an entire term looking at my drawings and saying, "I think you should take my sculpture class. I think you'd really like it. I can tell from how you draw that you'd be good at this." And I was so not interested. Like, I just wasn't interested in woodworking at all.
Yeah.
And he probably said that to me every class for 3 months. And so I finally signed up. And in that first project, I was addicted. Mm-hmm. Like, I started showing up at like 6 a.m. to work in the studio before 8 a.m. classes. And then I quit everything else. And I just was making sculpture.
It caught.
Yeah. It was like, it was my thing. I fell in love.
And up to that point, so from Minnesota to Montana to Oregon, had you ever engaged with art at all?
My mom wanted to be an artist, and she was of, you know, the generation where, you know, women weren't given very many choices. So she ended up a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
I think her parents told her they wouldn't pay for college if right. she went for art, which is really sad. So she was always really, she did a ton of art with us growing up. We were homeschooled because my oldest brother was deaf. And,
right.
You know, at the time that he went deaf, sign language was not accepted. Like, doctors were telling you not to teach your kids sign language because they'll never talk.
Mm.
And she just didn't want to do that. So we just wound up being homeschooled randomly.
Mm-hmm.
So she did a ton of art with us. And, you know, she was always like super encouraging. She just told us we could do whatever we wanted with our lives. So, yeah, I was just really lucky that way.
Yeah. Was that like intimidating to have the world be so open at all? Or did you find it to be super liberating and empowering?
I don't think I thought about it
uh-huh.
either way. I think, you know, in high school, everybody was like, oh, of course you should be an interpreter. And I think I just kind of internalized that. And so I just went to college to do this thing, and I'm sure it would have been fine. But I don't think it was like ever something I was really passionate about.
Right.
You know, so you know, I think I'm just really lucky.
It would have been a job.
Yeah, it would have been a job, which, you know, would have been fine.
Totally.
Yeah. I mean, if I hadn't taken this path, I wouldn't know any different probably. But, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it's always funny how things fall together.
Yeah.
Yeah, my parents had like my parents were very much of the ethos, like, you can do anything you want as well. And I found that to be super, fortunate.
Yeah.
Because I chose to do bonsai when I was like 12.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I found it super early on. And like, just like you took a sculpture class and you were like, that I'm in.
Yeah.
That's how it was for me. But it just happened really, really early on for me. And then, you know, my parents were like, you can do anything you want. And I was like, I want to do that. And they were like, well, so, ha, you know,
right.
it's kind of like I really put that back on them. Like, well, I thought I could do anything I wanted. Like what gives, you know? They're like, all right, at least go to college. And so then I went to college to study horticulture because I thought it could make me better at bonsai. And it, in fact, has been a huge like centrifuge of what we've been able to accomplish here. So they were correct.
Yeah.
And I was correct in terms of like that choice. But it was just really funny. I've spoken with people who have had that same wide open message delivered to them where they're like, it was almost too much, because then it's like, what do I do? I can do anything. Oh my gosh, what's enough?
Right.
What's not enough? I didn't think that hard about it either. I was just like, this is awesome. I'm going to do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then they're like, shit, what do we do? Like, what do we do to this kid? You know? Yeah. So yeah, it worked out. So how long have you been, you went to school in, what'd you say, Western Oregon?
Yeah, Western Oregon University in
okay.
Monmouth. Yeah.
And you changed to art, you took this class, showing up early, you're like in.
Yeah.
And then what happened?
So I took the beginning wood class and the beginning stone class. And wood just has so much more potential.
Mm-hmm.
Because you get your strength from your grain. And so you can, if you're working with your grain, you can make these long, crazy, delicate things that are still very strong.
Mm-hmm.
And stone, you know, I can make something 20 inches tall that weighs as much as me, and right. it gets its strength from its mass. So I gravitated towards wood.
Mm-hmm.
And wood just felt very alive to me in the way stone didn't. And I, you know, I'll play around with stone once in a while.
Yeah.
But nothing serious.
Doesn't have the same impact for you.
No, yeah. Not at all. Yeah.
So basically you sort of found this medium that you loved working with and you just kind of dedicated to that. And then you finished school. And then from school, where'd you go?
I finished school. And in undergrad, at least where I was, it was just sort of beat into your head that the only way you were going to ever succeed at this is you had to go get your master's and you had to become a teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wasn't interested. And I wasn't interested because in my first sculpture class, someone cut their fingers on a bandsaw. And I still to this day don't quite understand how. But they cut all the way down to bone and tendon and had to have surgery. And it was like really traumatizing. I was like 17 or 18, I was really young. And mm-hmm. I was like, I don't want to be responsible for kids and power tools ever. And I still feel that way. I'm just like, that doesn't interest me. Mm-hmm. Why would you let 18-year-olds use table saws with no one around? That's crazy.
Yeah, right.
So I think I decided really young that like this path I chose was just going to be really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just going to do it anyway. And so I think I'm really resilient.
Yeah.
And I've lived my life a lot of really interesting ways to like make it work financially when it was really hard.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been great. And I get frustrated because people are always asking about like, do you make a living doing this? And I think it's so interesting that we gauge so much on like financial success.
Yeah.
Like that's how we gauge our success. Because I feel like my life is so rich
mm-hmm.
because of the way I've chosen to live it and, you know, what I'm doing with my time. And for me, I always say time is money. Like I would rather have time than money.
Yeah.
Because with time I can make things.
Yeah.
So
you went from school not taking the graduate path and you went.
Yeah, I rented a studio. So I've got a job in Portland at a screen printing company. I was like a quality control manager, and I was working a shift where it was like 6 in the morning to 2:30. And I found a studio I rented a studio space in Portland before I even moved to Portland. Cause mm-hmm. I was like, I'm not moving until I have a place to work.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, you know, the size of 2 sheets of plywood or something. It was tiny. And so I would work, you know, from 6 in the morning till 2:30, and I'd go to the studio and I'd work till 10 in the studio.
Mm.
And then I would just do that every day. And I was really happy.
Yeah. When did you stop working at the screen printing place?
I only worked there for a year.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've had a lot of all kinds of jobs.
Yeah.
So I worked there for a year, and then I was kind of just doing temp stuff for a while. What kind of really helped project me into making art, like, just full time, was I became a caregiver.
Mm.
And so, I was working 24, 48 hour shifts. So just, you know, move into someone's home and take care of them for a weekend. And then I would have a normal life during the week.
Right.
I could work, you know, 8 to 5 in the shop and then go home and have dinner if I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
Or work 15 hours in the shop if I wanted.
Sure.
So I did that for like 8 years, mm-hmm. about, did that a long time. And now I sling beer at a little pub in Stevenson.
Nice.
And that's been really good because it's gotten me like socialized more.
Uh-huh.
Cause when you're alone all day in the studio, you just like lose perspective sometimes, turn into a creature of the night.
Yeah.
So.
A little hermitish.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's nice for that sense. You get out in the world talking to people.
Yeah. But I definitely have hermit-like tendencies.
Yeah. Like you just get lost.
Oh, for sure. And also like, there is never enough time.
Yeah.
And there's always more projects. There's always more things to make.
Yeah.
And so it's like, I can't go take time away from this, you know? And I very much relate with that. I have a wonderful team. I'm so happy I have them.
Yeah.
Because otherwise I probably would basically not leave this place.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm lucky enough to have an awesome kid too. So he helps me with that a lot as well.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah, it is pretty cool. But wow, that's interesting. So, I mean, we're looking at two of your pieces right now. One is Albatross, and then what's the title of the other one?
This is Strobilis.
Strobilis. And people can see these on your website?
Strobilis is on the website. Albatro would be on Instagram. It's not on my website.
Okay. And where can people find you?
LauraBuchan.com or Instagram, it's at LauraBuchanSculpture.
Cool. Yeah, and these are pieces, like, when I started following your work, these are two pieces that I've seen a lot. And so it was really cool. Like, I've been trying to come out and see your studio for a long time.
Yeah.
And you were in the Gorge, but I didn't know you were in Stevenson. So that means I've basically driven right by you a lot of times.
Yeah.
But then that, like, trying to get out there, and it's like, things here are pretty mental. So it didn't work out, and everything kind of serendipitously fell into place. I was in Houston when I was communicating with you.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Working. So trying, like, to, yeah. You know, just do life on the road a little bit.
Sure. But, yeah. I know all about that.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I mean, where do you... You said that... I'm sorry. I'm a little bit fried today. What was the name of that one?
Strobilis.
You said that was part of your, like, 2013. Is that what you said?
That one's like 2011, 2012.
Okay.
From my botany series.
Yeah.
And then Albatro is from 2013. And
okay.
I did a whole bunch of like ocean-based stuff that year.
And how do you decide? So do you do your bodies of work based on themes like that?
Not really that intentionally. I do a lot of visual research. I collect a lot of weird organic things in nature. I collect a lot of bones. And it's kind of like whatever wormhole I go down,
mm-hmm.
and get lost in. I've tried to be more intentional with, like, I should make a cohesive body of work. But the reality is that's just not how I function.
Mm-hmm.
And it's better for me to just, like, work with wherever my creative momentum is.
Yeah.
And that's something I've learned about myself. So that's what I do. But it does, you know, I think I have a very distinctive style. And so I think it doesn't really matter what I make thematically or mm-hmm. subject matter. It's going to feel cohesive because I'm using a lot of the same techniques and,
yeah.
you know. It's all natural forms.
How did this body of techniques that has created the style that represents your work, how did you construct that? Where did that come from?
I mean, I don't know. I have just been obsessed with like natural history my whole life. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was like 7, I wanted to be an archaeologist and dig up dinosaur bones and mummies and, you know, things.
Nice. Yeah.
And, you know, I grew up out in the country, you know, so I was like running around barefoot and mm-hmm. there's a lot of like wildlife around. We had animals. So there's, you know, there's a lot of hunting culture in Montana. Mm-hmm. So I was exposed to a lot of that as a kid and it just completely fascinated me. It was not gross at all.
Did your family hunt?
When we were in Montana a little bit. Yeah. Not since then. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, do you think that growing up in Montana kind of bred the curiosity that has fueled your artistic approach then?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think it had a big part to play in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because even though you moved away from Montana at the age of 12, you're still sort of touching back on that kind of point in your life. That's home.
Yeah.
Even home more than Stevenson is now?
No. It feels like it's where my, you know, it's where I spent my childhood.
Your
so
roots.
It's home in that sense, yeah. But, you know, it's been years since I left there.
Yeah.
And I don't have family there. So I only go back through there if I'm driving through for work or something.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like Stevenson's home, actually.
Yeah.
More than almost anywhere I've been.
You like Stevenson?
Yeah, I like it in the Gorge. It's great. It's been really interesting moving to a really tiny town. I was in Portland for 9 years before that. And the hard thing about it was that you lose all anonymity. Like there's everywhere you go, like I don't go to the grocery store there. I buy groceries in Portland.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because I just, you know, I already work at like the most popular little drinking establishment in town. So you just run into everyone and you have the same conversations over and over. But it's also, there's something really endearing about it that I've learned to appreciate, you know?
Yeah.
So, and I've got a ton of friends that are artists out there. And I've got I have a great artist community. I have a great queer community. I have all these things that I actually didn't have in Portland that has just been really nice that I didn't expect. So
there is a congregation of artists in Stevenson?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I have a number of friends that are making art.
That's so fascinating to me. So I grew up in Colorado, and then I went to school in San Luis Obispo, California.
Okay.
And then I moved to Japan, and when it came time, I was in Japan trying to figure out where I was going to be. My original plan was to be in California, and it totally fell apart, like burned to the ground, fell apart. And so then I was like, oh my gosh, what am I going to do? And I couldn't go back to Colorado. Not because I love Colorado. That's home in my mind. But it's not conducive to doing what I wanted to do. And so then it was like, there was like a small kind of enclave of bonsai people up here. And I kind of reached out to them. I'd become more and more like communicative with the group that was here. And they were basically like, yeah, come on out. And so I chose to move here without having ever been here before, which was really interesting. Because I didn't even know what Oregon looked like. I'd never been to Oregon before.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. I knew it was good. I knew it was great for like growing trees and all that stuff. It's like the nursery capital of the world and all. And I knew that there was a community of people out here in terms of bonsai, but one of the really shocking things to me is I had no idea how many different mediums people were working with. And even like out here, Columbia County is kind of the reject portion of Portland, right? It's like Highway 30. I'm not trying to like slander Columbia County, but I mean, it's like the last, when you look at all of the areas around Portland,
it is.
This is the last untouched place.
It's kind of weird like that.
And a lot of people from Portland that come out here are like, we never go down Highway 30 unless we're going to Astoria or the ocean.
Yeah.
And typically they won't even go down Highway 30 to go to the ocean.
No, I think people go as far as Stavies and then stop.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
To pick some berries and yeah. And so, but coming out here, it's like Michael Curry Studios is in Scappoose. They make a majority of the animatronics and puppets for Broadway in New York and around the world. They've done a lot of work doing any number of things, Muppets, Lion King, a lot of installations for the Bellagio around the world. And like the metalworking community out here is the best in the world. Some of the best craftspeople in the world. There's still a traditional like medieval armor chainmail maker. On this side of Portland. And one of the people that we've collaborated with was one of the sort of like head design build people at Michael Curry Studios, who's gone out on his own. So we work with him on all manner of metal fabrication, from like sculptural pieces to really functional work and stuff. I had no idea. Like one of the ceramicists whose work we use and is really highly thought of and highly coveted lives right down the street from us.
Wow.
Yeah. Just like really. And I had no idea. Like I came here because I was like, I can grow trees. Somehow we'll be able to find everything else throughout North America. And it's kind of all been right here.
That's great.
We work with a really incredible furniture maker in Portland who builds a lot of the woodwork that we use and stuff. Yeah, it's just been, and I was just thinking about how can I grow the trees to the best of my ability? You know, like I was like, I'll figure everything else out. that seems like the centrifuge of what I need. And it's just turned into so much more. It's been amazing.
That's cool. How long have you been here?
10 years. This is the 10th year.
That's right. You said that.
Yeah. Yeah. So I came back from Japan in 2010, early 2010.
Okay.
Like I think I flew back in March or something.
Wow.
Yeah. So this whole place has been, it's like a constant, you probably saw like the half built stuff everywhere. It's like a constant project. Yeah. Yeah. It's been really fun though.
That's awesome. It's beautiful out here.
Thanks. Thanks. Yeah. I would really like for things to be like finished built.
Yeah. Well,
but, you know, I also recognize part of my process is like letting it marinate for five to eight years before we get around to finishing it.
Yeah.
That seems to be kind of my,
I've got some things lying around
it,
like that.
Is it good?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that makes me feel better.
Yeah. It's hard to not have things like that when you make stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's always like the ideas are happening too fast to be able to finish every single one of them.
Yep.
Like that, and that's not to say we haven't finished stuff, but it is also to say like that energy of the generation of an idea is pretty addicting.
Yeah. Do you have a hard time coming back to something you've started after it's been a period of time and finishing it?
Yeah. It's almost like a mental block for me anyways. Yeah. Because it's not like I've lost the interest in it. It's like it's hard to continue to stop the new interests that continue to arise, right?
Yeah.
So it's just almost like a order of priorities. But I'm also like the way that my mind works is I'm a very like systematic, logical person. I think very much in organizational strategies, which allows me to educate about bonsai, I think. And this whole place has just become like a giant petri dish for that approach. But inside of that, I hate seeing things unfinished. And that's where you said, like, I'd rather have time than money.
Yeah.
Like, I wish that my physical body didn't have to sleep.
Oh, me too.
Because I wouldn't sleep.
Yeah, no. I think sleep should be, like, a leisure activity that
totally.
You can choose.
It's like what it feels like, right?
Yeah. Like, I'm still waiting for, like, the all-natural pill that you just, like, swallow.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Seeking it every day, right? Like, what can I do to potentially not sleep and not have it just completely crush me?
Yeah, I know. I would love if you figure it out.
Oh, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, well, we'll stay in contact about that. Yeah. So what's on the, well, I've got like a lot of questions for you, so I'm going to try to just like keep it mellow. But what's the current sort of LB project right now?
Right now, actually, 2019 has been like sitting on a computer mostly so far, which has been incredibly frustrating, but it's paying off, so it's fine.
Like putting your work out there,
yeah,
or
so,
just being like a responsible adult? Like, what is that? Because I relate to that.
So, I mean, as a visual artist, I have to be constantly applying for shows. You know, so I've been applying for grants this year, applying for shows, applying for a lot of new stuff. 2018, I was so busy with shows. I did five like big shows, mm-hmm. and a lot of them were just like back to back to back. The last two were solo shows, and the last one was a really big solo show.
What was that one?
It was in Ellensburg at Central Washington University.
Okay.
And their gallery space is just huge. I mean, it was great.
It's a Sarah something gallery.
Yeah, the Sarah Spurgeon Gallery.
Okay.
Yeah. Have you been in that space?
No.
That's great. They have really high ceilings and they let me hang a bunch of stuff, which not every space can do that.
Yeah.
So when I have the opportunity, I try and take advantage of it. So I kind of just spent all year just making as much work as possible, and just like the shows were just like building on each other all year.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wasn't actively trying to sell anything last year because I needed it all.
Yeah.
And then I didn't have time to apply for anything last year. And that, you know, things come and go,
mm-hmm.
like that. So, you know, you spend all this time making stuff and then you spend a month on the computer. So my 2019 schedule is just quiet,
mm-hmm.
Which is nice. But I, you know, kind of like dug in and really focused on doing some grant writing and applying for shows and different things. And I have like one more big thing I'm applying for. And then I'm just like, I just need to make work for a while.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter what's happening on the internet.
There you
I'm
go.
I'm not going to look at it. So
are you compelled to make work, or do you need to make work because of all of the shows that you're applying for? How does that work for you?
No, I am always compelled to make work.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that, you know, it doesn't do me any good sitting on a shelf where nobody's seen it.
Yeah.
So, and there's no way to get yourself out there if you're not actively showing.
Yeah.
So that's part of the process.
When you... So, like, the Sarah Spurgeon Gallery, they allowed you to hang a lot of stuff. Not every place allows you the same opportunity to display your work in that fashion. Do you ever find that frustrating to have those limitations to the way that you can present your work? Or do you ever have times where people want to present your work in a way that doesn't feel good to you? And, like, how do you deal with that kind of conflict?
Yeah, I mean, I've, you know... All, you know, everyone's different, right? So some galleries are definitely like sales galleries and, you know, you walk in and it's just like floor to ceiling covered with stuff.
Yeah.
And then, you know, some galleries are really sparse and minimal and, you know, it's done really nicely. I like have my own aesthetic preferences, but I try to not project them too much. The thing that I ask is that it's hung at eye level because mm-hmm. that's how it's designed to be seen. And also it's like, it's usually fairly large work and it's not, I make it as light as possible, but they're not all light pieces. So I don't, if I'm not hanging the work myself, I don't want someone hanging something up way high, not knowing how they did it. Mm-hmm. 'Cause I know a lot of people don't like to fit anchors in the walls.
Right.
So, you know, for safety concerns, I don't want that either.
Yeah.
As far as frustrating me as the way I want to display things and the things I want to make, I made a lot of suspended work in 2016. I love working like in fully 3D without having to think about like the way it sits or balances or like the flat part that has to touch the wall.
Mm-hmm.
But I have the thing that has been frustrating is suspended work is just really hard to sell.
Yeah.
So even though it's amazing and everyone wants to talk about it, it's not very residential friendly.
Yeah.
So, you know, wall hanging, as far as selling work, wall hanging work is where it's at.
Yeah.
But it's not always what I want to do.
Yeah.
So.
Isn't that just the shits?
I've really made the choice to make what I want to make and to not make things based on what I think is going to sell or what I think my audience wants. Because there's been a couple moments where I've like tried to do that. Like the botanical body of work just flew out the door, and all the commissions I do are typically botanical based. Mm-hmm. And that's great. They're lovely, but they're not, you know, the thing that interests me the most right now. But I've been in places where I'm like, well, you know, this is the thing that sells the best, so I should just always have one of these in process. And they, if I'm not excited about it, they take me months to finish, and it doesn't make me want to be in the studio. So I've stopped. I just don't do that to myself.
That's really, I would put almost everything that I could on a rock just because, like, you know, for me with bonsai, so many people equate it to a Japanese art form, which, you know, like, I have my own thoughts about that. I mean, the Japanese manipulated a Chinese art form and sort of applied their cultural impression and aspects to it. And that's what made what we know of as bonsai. And now, you know, like, the thing that got me into it was actually seeing back in Colorado, my original mentor was one of the sort of original collectors in the Rocky Mountains that went out and found stunted trees in the natural environment. He was a Japanese American born in Hawaii, and moved to Colorado and sort of saw this as a really almost like just intuitively, this is what it's supposed to be. And that was my impression of bonsai from very early on. Is like, I grew up in the Rockies. That's what I recognized.
Yeah.
And these stunted trees that were very familiar to me, taking those and working with them and sort of this collaboration conversation, because it is a living thing, made it really, it was really appealing to me. And then seeing the radical forms that exist there and comparing them to the Japanese form, which I think is more like a cultural impression of a repetition of pattern, which is very much, when you look at sort of the concepts that you could quantify Japanese culture as, it makes a lot of sense, right? This is a duplication of the process,
sure,
incrementally pursuing perfection on a daily basis. This is the definition of a shokunin, right? And so I get it, and it's beautiful, and I love the Japanese form, and I apprenticed there for 6 years, and I like worked with it a lot and have the utmost respect for it. But for me, I already knew what we had in North America, which is a very special thing. I mean, we have forests that are the most ancient. We have forests that are the biggest, are the tallest, mm-hmm, are the most radical forms of what nature can do to a living thing. And that's really why I got into bonsai. You know, and when I went to Japan, I really wanted the techniques. The master that I studied with could do radical things, and I wanted to be able to do radical things because the things that I worked on were already radical and the techniques I needed were big. And so in getting that, my intention always in Japan was to come back and be working with our native material and exploring the forms that, like, I recognized growing up in the Rockies, but also going to school in California, saw in the Sierras, where I spent most of my time when I didn't have too much homework. And like, since then, exploring North America has become like this, almost like the forefront of all of my pursuits, because to be out there means I have so many more ideas to come back here with, you know? So it's almost like it's what has to happen before I can come back and apply that to this miniaturized, you know, abstraction, as it sort of filters through me and everything that I've like seen, you know, like every idea morphs.
Yeah.
You can't, unless you're looking at something directly, it's always going to change form a little bit, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
And I love that. Because then that's where everybody's filter of themselves changes, mm-hmm, what they saw and how they represent it. I think that's so rad. I mean, I see it in your work, and I think it's awesome to, it's very inspiring to see that abstraction when somebody executes it with a high level of craft and beauty and care and intentionality. So you know, now where we're at with the art of bonsai, like a lot of the discussion in Houston, which was the American Bonsai Society's annual event, I gave a talk in 2011, I gave a talk on the future of American bonsai, and it was sort of an off the cuff thing that they asked me to do. And I was happy to do it, but I didn't have like a backbone for it. I just had like the ideas of how we build a community from like taking in the observations of Europe and Japan, and where it seemed like they had gone right and where it seemed like they had gone wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And then it was interesting to go back, and they asked me to give a talk again about the subject, but now 2011 to 2019, our community and this art form of bonsai is evolving at a like an exponential pace right now, because you have so many more trained people with so many more abstractions of what they're trying to pursue. And the technique is finally there to really treat it as art and play with the technique. It's empowering because you can actualize the concepts of sure. your imagination and design.
Yeah.
And so you're seeing this renovation of the concept and this manipulation of the concept. And it is, it's to some degree, like it is deviating away from bonsai as its title, just the same as Pinjing deviated, you know, bonsai deviated from Pinjing, which is the Chinese form. And, mm-hmm. and you can't stop that growth if you're treating it as an art form, right?
Right. Yeah.
It's natural. It's intuitive.
Yeah.
It has to.
Yeah.
Or else it's going to die.
Yeah.
You know, whether you're talking about the physical living thing has to grow or it's going to die, or you're talking about the idea and the inspiration has to grow or it's going to die.
Yeah.
And so it was really interesting to try and have that discussion again 8 years later, you know,
like
yeah. I've changed a lot. The community's changed a lot.
Yeah.
The level has changed a lot, and it's yeah. really, it's pretty exciting.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Do you have a lot of, are there people that are really only interested in like bonsai in its most traditional
yeah.
form that
yeah.
really push back?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think particularly when I first came back in 2010 and for the first 3 or 4 years, I mean, it was like a huge pushback. And it was like there was a lot of internal conflict for me too, because an apprenticeship in Japan is kind of an institutionalizing thing.
Yeah.
I mean, like I committed to a master, and you really, for the master that I committed to, he's extremely intense. You kind of have to give yourself to his process, like good, the good and the bad.
Yeah.
And so you start to gauge your success on his approval or disapproval of your work, but you're actualizing his idea constantly.
Right.
And so then like, I literally like could feel inside myself, like all these ideas, and I was just sort of like cramming them in, you know, like I have this super tattered like idea book that's filled with like Japanese yogurt cup tops that I've like doodled on and like tried to clean them off. They're like stuck to the pages in it and stuff, uh-huh. you know, like just trying to not lose all the ideas that I wanted to actualize when I came back.
Yeah.
And then when I got home for the first part of it, I couldn't shed the question of what would he want me to be doing.
Right.
And so the first 2 years were basically a wash as far as, and not a wash because they were valuable. Like I had to struggle with that transition, and I had to try and repeat his process and his style to understand that it doesn't work here. And it gave me such a greater awareness of where, you know, anybody can only create something that's genuine if it's representative of the place and the culture and the person and stuff.
Right.
And that really formed the principles that through like a series of experiences I had going back to Japan, sort of obligatory trips back to Japan to help with the transition, leaving as the lead apprentice and making sure the younger apprentices are carrying the weight.
Uh-huh.
I was pretty rapidly no longer a part of the family of apprentices because I'm not Japanese.
Yeah.
And that really helped. It really hurt because like I worked so hard to like try and maintain the integrity of his garden.
Yeah.
And try to not be the weak link that anybody looked at and they're like, well, he was the best in the world until this, you know, foreigner was his apprentice. But I also like was, it helped me detach from that feeling of obligation to like continue to represent his work and
yeah.
not sort of go off on my own. So it was a really weird journey, but it all kind of came very seamlessly and serendipitously with the efforts to try and make a living doing bonsai, which is as gnarly as any other medium to try and survive that. Yeah. And, you know, the creation of art or design, yeah, or, you know,
yeah,
it's never been easy. It's probably never going to be easy.
No, I don't think so.
Yeah. But I mean, it took me driving across the country multiple times and seeing the shift of North America and being like, oh, this is a very special place. You know, people in the Midwest, like, they're Midwesterners, you know, and they talk different, they think differently, they eat differently, they dress differently.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow, why is that so different? And you all of a sudden start to recognize, like, the impact of that environment on the person,
mm-hmm,
and the culture that exists there and the things that are the values that they hold. And then all of a sudden it all stems from the natural environment that we are becoming a little bit monochromatic in our style and dress and fashion and taste and whatnot. And, mm-hmm, and I think that's largely driven by sort of the technology taking away the influences of the place on people.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's really sad. There's a few places in the country that I think preserve that really beautifully. Coastal California would be one of them, because no matter how much technology exists, it never really works very well in Humboldt or Mendocino.
Yeah.
You know, like, and surfing is always going to usurp,
yeah,
Googling. And so the lifestyle and the pace still hasn't changed.
Right.
In the Midwest is still this very slow, really beautifully simple lifestyle. And there's a lot of tchotchkes in everybody's houses, and it's wonderful. You know, like, you're not going to take the Midwest out of the Midwest.
Right. Yeah.
And no New Yorker is ever going to be less aggressive, you know? So you just, like, have these pockets of preservation of culture that is phenomenal. It's amazing. I really, over the course of my apprenticeship, I became very proud to be from North America. Because it is a very special place.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's fun to try and represent it in an art form. Yeah. What's your favorite wood to work with?
Maple is my favorite wood to work with. Or it's my favorite thing to see a finished product in.
Mm-hmm.
But I use a lot more alder.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, similar in tone. It's softer. It's a little less expensive. I can probably make twice the amount of work in the same amount of time just because it's a little softer.
Yeah.
So
when you say maple, are you talking about big leaf maple? Native maple, yeah. Like hardwood maple?
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's just super gnarly to work with in terms of hardness.
It's just harder, so it just takes longer.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really all there is to it.
Yeah.
You know.
So you're working with lamination to piece your pieces together, and then you're removing all of the excess material?
Yeah. So I'm just buying lumber, like kiln-dried rough lumber, and I'm milling it up and laminating it. Some of them are really simple. You're just like stacking boards together and gluing them. And then a lot of them are really complex where I'm using a vacuum bag and doing bent laminations and all kinds of things like that. A lot of things, I utilize a lot of hollow forms in my work. And a lot of that has to do with weight, just trying to keep the weight down. So a lot of things are carved in multiple pieces partially and then put together and finished carved.
Oh, wow.
So, Albatross is an example of that. That was done in two pieces and then put together, and then I finished it. So,
So you have to have like a lot of foresight into, like, do you draw out your pieces before you do them?
Yeah. So, I mean, I have like a million sketchbooks and they're all like super organized. There's a table of contents. I can go back and reference things. There's notes. I mean,
that's awesome.
It's serious. And so once I've, you know, drawn things in a sketchbook and I'm sort of settled on an idea, I'll move and I'll draw it full scale. So I'll just take my sketchbook to Kinko's and blow it up. And sometimes I'll blow it up like to three different sizes
because
you really don't know till you see it what's going to feel right.
Mm-hmm.
So once I've done that, I draw it full scale on just like butcher paper.
Yeah.
And I always do two views. So I'll rotate it 90 degrees. and draw the side view. And then I just use those drawings as my maps for laminations.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll mill up my lumber and then measure it and actually draw those lines on the drawings. So I'm not, you know, I don't end up with a giant block. I end up with something in this weird blocky silhouette shape.
Yeah.
And I cut things out on the bandsaw. And then I'm carving with an angle grinder and a die grinder.
A Lancelot, is that what you use?
I actually don't use that.
Oh, you don't?
No, I'm scared of it.
It's like an arm eater.
Yeah, it's just not. I use a resin disc. It's like 24 grit or 36 grit.
Okay.
Just a really rough, turns everything to dust.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
So there's like a picture in your Instagram where you have a Lancelot and it's like, oh, it's a Lancelot.
Yeah. Yeah. I bought one.
Yeah.
And I use it.
Yeah. For good reason.
Yeah. I just got so many stories of people that were like, oh, I ripped my leg open. And,
yeah.
And I don't really clamp my work down. Usually.
Okay.
So it's a lot of it's big enough that it doesn't really need to be clamped down.
Yeah.
But I work with one hand in an angle grinder all the time.
Oh, that's burly.
Yeah, it's just, you know, you got to be careful.
Yeah, right.
So.
Right. And you were saying that you've got to kind of preserve your hands. Does it tear your hands up pretty hardcore to do what you do?
Yeah. Back in, I think it was probably 2013, I was dealing with like so much chronic pain. I was like coming out of the studio and I felt like I had claws for hands, and I was having trouble like tying and untying my shoes. And I started seeing an acupuncturist and it did wonders for me.
Nice.
But yeah, you have to stretch a lot. I work a little more strategically now so that I have breaks and I'm not just using it like vibrating power tools for 12 hours every day, all day, which is what I used to do. So I just have to be more intentional about it.
Do you have to ever have to ice or anything like that?
I have before. I don't do that much.
Yeah.
You're kind of used to it.
Yeah.
You know, when it's what you do all the time, you don't really think about it as much as maybe you should. So
you ever worry about like arthritis just tearing your hands apart?
I do. I think like my biggest fears are something like that, or like breaking an arm or breaking a hand.
Yeah.
Like, you know, like I don't rock climb because I don't, well, one, I don't trust my hands to not give out. And I, you know, I just don't want to break anything.
Yeah.
So I don't want to stop production.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm very familiar with the claw.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just part of working with your hands, I guess. I don't know. Like, I worry about arthritis constantly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because it's just arthritis would be a game changer for what we do.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't even know what I would do.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, I mean, finishing your work. So you're working with a resin disc to just basically do the heavy removal and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
What does it look like to refine your work?
I don't refine things nearly as much as I used to.
Mm.
And that's kind of going back to what you were talking about getting away from, you know, this super traditional way you were taught to do things and kind of breaking out of the mold and figuring out your own voice in it. I kind of went through that with finishing. Because in school, you know, we had to sand everything to like 320 or 400 or something, and put finish on everything. And so I did that for a number of years out of college, and I would spend so much time on these things and I would get them exactly how I wanted them. And then I would put finish on it and it would completely change the piece. And I hated it. And there's like one piece from years ago that I probably sanded back like four times.
Oh no.
You know, like, cause I just, and one day, and it didn't even occur to me that it was an option to not put finish on things. And one day I work with a guy doing art handling. I've been working with him for about 10 years. And we were having a conversation about it. And he was like, well, just don't do it. Like, you're the artist. And it was like a light bulb. It was like someone gave me permission to like do something different. And so I stopped putting finish on the work. And it's been so great.
Super liberating.
Yes. super liberating for multiple reasons, because I don't have to sand it to 400 anymore.
Right.
Because if you're not going to put finish on it, it's not going to pick up every little imperfection. And I love the raw wood.
Yeah.
You know, when you put finish on it, it takes that away. It makes it this thing in the world that's not alive anymore.
Yeah. Where would your pieces, like when you create these pieces and you, well, I guess, do you have a vision for where you would want to see these pieces when you create them? Are you like, God, I hope this lives in something like this someday?
I don't really think about the life of them, like outside my studio.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to work on a much larger scale. So I'd like to break into like public art.
Yeah.
And I think in those ideas in my brain, I have, you know, I have bigger ideas for those things, because I want them to be things people can like walk inside of and mm-hmm. walk through and interact with in that way. But for these, you know, they're wall hanging pieces. They're appropriately sized for someone's residence. You know, in a perfect world, they're going to be on a pristine white wall and not be cluttered by anything. And
yeah.
That's not reality at all.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. But I'm done with it before I've sanded it. Like I'm over it. Like, the idea is done. It's out of my brain. Like, I'm ready to move on.
Yeah.
You know, and usually it takes me like 3 months. Like, I'll come back to something 3 months and see it on a wall and be like, oh, that was a nice thing I made.
Mm.
But like when I'm making it, there's a like very strong love-hate relationship that's constantly happening.
Yeah. I mean, you had asked me earlier if it's hard for me to revisit work that I haven't finished. Is it hard for you?
It's very hard.
Is it?
Yeah. That's been one of the things I've been doing this year, because I've just been spending so much time on the computer, and I haven't really had time to like dive into a new idea.
Mm.
Or, you know, I know if I do, I'm just going to lose myself and like lose momentum on the stuff that needs to happen.
Yeah.
So I've been forcing myself to pick up all the unfinished projects and try and finish them.
Yeah.
And it's like excruciating.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, you can get back into it and eventually it'll happen.
Yeah.
But it's like, you just have to show up every day and be like, I'm going to put X amount of hours into this and make yourself do it, and it'll appear. You know, I never lose faith that it's going to happen.
You don't?
No.
Like, you never have, or is that something that you've learned?
I think it's something I've learned, but I can't really think of something that I've like actually like trashed.
Mm-hmm.
Like, where I feel like, oh, it's ruined, I've trashed it, I'm not going to finish it. I finish everything. It's just like, even if I hate it and I think it's bad and it's not something I want to show, like, I follow the idea all the way through.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And for those pieces that, even if you, so it sounds to me like you don't ever get to a point where you actually hate it, because you've never trashed anything. But in those pieces that you do follow through and you've sort of hated it that whole time, does that impact the other work that you do?
Like, how so?
I don't know. Maybe changing your approach to the work that you do after that, or steering away from the subject matter or whatever didn't come together in that process.
I don't think so. I mean, each piece kind of feels like this very unique thing to me. I think what I do when I return to old work is, you know, sort of get really frustrated that I didn't take notes.
But I thought you said your sketchbook was like this encyclopedia of your process.
I mean, I've got a pretty clear idea, but like, you know, when you're in something and you're making it, you know, it's like, it's so clearly planned out in my brain. It's like, I have to do this first and then this first and then this first, mm-hmm. and then it all comes together. And so if I walk away from it, and I come back, I've lost kind of that process.
Yeah.
And I'm usually like maybe in a little bit too much of a hurry. Like, you know, I don't go back to that place and start all over and be like, okay, what has to happen to get it? And so the pieces will end up like heavier than they should because, you know, I didn't, you know, I glued something together too soon and I didn't hollow it out enough, or, you know, it's things the public would never know.
Yeah, sure.
That only I know, that drive me crazy.
Yeah.
But I've also learned that, you know, like I used to just look at, everything used to take so long. I used to look at pieces and just agonize over what I do next. It's like, I could do this or I could do this. And there's no going back. Like you make that decision. That's the path you're going down. And now I'm just like, no one's ever going to know there was even another option.
Yeah.
And so I just make choices now. And that's been probably one of the most valuable things that I've learned to do in my studio is like, at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
You know, like they're both my ideas. No one's going to know what the other possibility was. The other thing's going to come out in another piece, you know, whatever that idea is, you know, it's going to resurface. It's not like it's lost forever.
It's almost like freeing yourself of that conflict or something, or that like that like feeling of like needing to maintain that control over the process.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting. That's super interesting. That's a really difficult thing to play around with, though. Like that, you get to those crossroads, and then you're like, "Ah, where do I go?" And wanting it to be right, like that concept of right.
Yeah.
That definitely, I really relate with that a lot.
Like
right stops existing the longer that you do it.
Mm-hmm.
Because there is just, it's just a different road.
Yeah, exactly.
Different road.
Yeah, that's, I think when I talk to my friends about making art, that's my advice I always give.
Yeah.
Like, no one else knows.
Yeah.
No one knows what the other possibility was.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a guy bring a tree up today, and he's like, I'm so reluctant to bring this to you because I cut this branch off. And I was like, well, the advantage is I never knew it existed, so I don't know any different. And he's just like, huh, yeah, I feel better about it already. I was like, yeah.
Exactly.
Like, yeah, yeah. Yeah. I made so many mortal sins as an apprentice with my master, breaking off branches, tearing, just like, of all of his apprentices, I made the most mistakes. Like, and not just like small mistakes. I made the big, nobody's ever done this before. None of my older apprentices knew how to handle that situation. I was just like alone on an island out there. Like, I just tore the biggest branch off of this tree that's supposed to go into the national. So the Kokufu exhibition in Tokyo in Japan drives the whole economy of bonsai.
Okay.
And a bonsai professional is preparing their clients' trees for this exhibition. So these are like highly prized, very valuable, delicate trees. You don't screw up on these trees. Well, I've screwed up on a lot of them. Right. And big screw ups. Right. And so watching his reaction to that, which he's very creatively brilliant. So he turns every like lemons into lemonade, you know, like not without pain, but like he makes those adjustments, and watching him do that. And then over the course of being here, working with so many trees, like you can only really control so much.
Yeah.
So you have to have that mentality. Otherwise there is never a right or a wrong, and there's never a ruined.
Right.
Because there's always just another option.
Yeah.
So it's very serendipitous that I was kind of such a, I wouldn't say like I was a fuck up or anything like that, but I was not afraid to make a mistake. And consequently I made a lot of them, and it helped me learn more maybe than other people did.
Yeah.
But it was painful to make those mistakes. But that freedom of trying to maintain that control is probably what's informed our process here more than anything else. Cause then it's just like, oh, this happened and we didn't expect it. And it's like, oh, cool. Look at what happened as a result of that.
Right.
And that's not something you would ever create.
Yeah. And I think you really, as a creative, it's really important to be flexible that way.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, like most of the time, my pieces turn out exactly like the drawings, but sometimes they get chunks chopped off and they get turned upside down and it's a completely different thing.
Yeah.
You know, and you just have to be open to those things because not everything works the way you envision it in your mind the first time around.
Yeah.
So.
And I wanted to ask you, when you blow, so you go down to Kinko's with your sketchbook and you blow it up to three different sizes and you say, one size works or other sizes don't. What does works mean? Like for your pieces, if Albatro were bigger or smaller and it wouldn't work, and this size does work, what does that mean?
It's more like a feeling, you know, you hang it on the wall and one of them feels right. Sometimes it's just common sense. Like, you know, if you're making something 10 feet, like you always want to make it 12.
Mm-hmm.
And then you make the 10 foot version and you're like, thank God I made it 10 feet, because 12 feet would have been exponentially so much more work. And you don't realize it till you're in it. And so much of the things I'm doing is I'm really technically challenging myself,
mm-hmm.
and I'm always trying new things. And so it's always kind of a crapshoot. It's like,
yeah,
I mean, I have faith that it's going to work, but I don't always know how.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I've learned to err on the side of like, if it's a technical challenge,
mm-hmm.
it's like, don't go so crazy that you're going to kill yourself over it.
Yeah. Have you ever tried to go so big that it just didn't work? I mean, you can kill yourself to make it work. Have you ever just had it be like, I went too far this time?
No, I don't get to work that big very often.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I would love to work that big all the time, but then I'm going to be paying for a lot of storage.
Yeah, right.
You know, so unless it's got a home, it's really hard to, or unless it's got like a show that it's committed to, it's really hard to make work that big.
Even when you go to a show though, are these shows where your pieces potentially sell at the show?
Potentially.
Okay.
I don't expect anything to sell at that scale.
Yeah.
I mean, it really needs like a corporate home or something.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
But I made, so I, in 2016, I did a public art installation in Seattle Center, and I did outdoor pieces, and one was 10 feet and one was 6 feet, and they were displayed together, and they were like the big crustacean type pieces. Like what you saw at Skylab, except on a much bigger scale. And so I made those, and the installation was like 6 months, 5 or 6 months. And then I had to bring them back, and it sat in my studio for a year in an open crate. And then I was like, I'm done storing these.
Yeah, right.
I'm going to dumpster them. And I had clients that collectors that I'm friends with, and they made a studio visit and they were like, you're throwing that away.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, I can't store it anymore. You know, and I mean, to find a home for something like that, for me at the time, I just didn't have the bandwidth. And they were like, we'll take it. And I was like, okay. I mean, if you want to rent a truck and come get it,
sure,
by all means. And they did. And it was really funny because like they felt like they were taking advantage of me, because I was just like, I will gift you this if you make it go away. And they, and then I felt like I was taking advantage of them, because I was like, you rented a truck and drove all the way out here, you know? And so we just mutually agreed, everybody's happy. And then they actually put in all this legwork and placed the pieces. So Ooh. They're going to be publicly displayed on a college campus, and it hasn't been installed yet, but it was amazing. Because, I mean, that's the kind of thing I don't have enough time in my day to try to do that.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a job in itself.
Yeah, it really is.
Installing the work. Yeah.
Finding places to install it.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. There's so much. It's like, I've always tried to understand, what is the thing that makes like really highly coveted or highly sought after art so coveted and sought after? And like, because it's such, and I hate the conversations where I was like, somebody stuck a hay bale in a room and like anybody could do that. It's like, okay, but you didn't. And like, you don't have the name from all the other work that made the hay bale valuable or whatever, you know, somebody stuck a urinal on the wall. How dare that be considered? Okay, cool.
Right.
But looking at like the, like, what is the intangible? And the only thing that I can really come up with is a really high level of craft and a significant degree of suffering. Like, those are the only two things that I can, because when you look at it, it's like, I mean, I can't believe somebody did that. You know, I can't imagine the hours, imagine the pain, imagine the constraints of just the mobility, the construction, the creation, like,
yeah.
And it's beautiful. Like, those are the only two things that I can find that are consistent across what is really seems to be, from my perspective, which is very limited in terms of like high art, but seems to be like, when I look at it, I'm like, what is the consistent theme? Like, those two things seem to always be there.
Yeah. I mean, I think at the end of the day, you just have to show up every day,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, you have to, it's your job. You have to show up and clock in and clock out and put in the time. And I mean, you could be in the studio for weeks. And I mean, for what you do, I mean, maybe years, right? Mm. And you feel like nothing changes,
mm-hmm.
and then something will appear. And I think the people that are really successful are the ones that just like show up every day.
Yeah. Wow. There's a ceramicist that we work with, Jonathan Cross. We've got some of his work downstairs, but it's this beautiful, geometric carved pieces that he makes. And he has like a makeshift place out in Joshua Tree,
mm-hmm.
that he goes out and has a technique to preparing the clay, goes through this arduous process of prepping it, has all of these machetes and different devices that he carves it with, you know, and it's, he's like fully captivated by the moment. We went down and sort of captured his process, the film team did, just because it's so fascinating. He's a really cool dude. And then he fires it for 3 to 4 days, and he's the only person manning the wood kiln.
Oh wow.
So at the peak of the firing, he's getting 10 minute naps in between stoking the fire, and sometimes it's 110 degrees. And sometimes it's 80 mile an hour winds, and sometimes it's freaking cold. And he's the only person out there through this process. And just sort of thinking about, he goes out there, he's got, you know, his family lives in LA so that his kids have a good school to go to. He goes out there on Monday, he comes back on Friday, and just the idea of showing up. But his like backbone to understanding that work ethic was that he used to be a printmaker,
mm-hmm.
and he worked alongside Richard Serra.
Oh, wow.
And so he did all of the print work for Richard Serra's sketches, which is like a far bigger body of work than his big, huge installation pieces.
Oh, yeah.
And he said that Richard Serra would work 3 to 5 of them into the ground every day. Showed up, put his overalls on, stopped for like 20 minutes for lunch, a sandwich, a cup of coffee, and just made work compulsively.
Yeah.
And didn't shut it down until everybody else was totally crushed and he was still going. And when he was ready and on his terms, he shut it down. And he would show up the next day and do it again, and the next day and do it again. And he might take a break to go look at the installation happening at LACMA or something like
right.
that. And then he would be back to continue working. And that, yeah, I mean, what you just said sounds exactly like that. Just showing up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think, you know, for people like that, it's like breathing air, right? Like creating is like breathing. Like we just can't not do it.
Mm.
So, I mean, our only choice is to show up.
Yeah.
Because what else would I be doing?
Yeah.
I think about that sometimes and I can't come up with anything. You know, I mean, I'd be doing social work of some kind or something, you know, that was important to me that mm-hmm. I believed in. But it wouldn't be like this. You know, like, I'm not going to burn out on this, you know.
Do people ever talk to you about burning out? Does anybody ever express concern? Like, Laura, you need to just pace yourself. We don't want you to burn out. Do you ever hear that?
Yeah, I've heard that a lot, but not only because of sculpture, just because of my work schedule in general.
Mm.
And being a caregiver, like, definitely burns people out.
Yeah.
Pretty badly. So, yeah, I've heard that quite a few times.
Yeah. And have you ever had low points of creativity where you're like, I just don't have it. I just don't have it, or I don't want to do it.
Yeah, definitely. And it's kind of a cycle. It's like when you get in that cycle, it's a bad cycle where it reinforces itself, because if I'm not making work, I get depressed. Mm-hmm. And if I get depressed, then it's harder to get in the studio.
Yeah.
And so it's this cycle that just kind of, so for me, like, I just go to the studio and it doesn't matter if I accomplish nothing. If I'm like staring at the wall for 8 hours, it doesn't matter because I'm in the studio.
Mm.
Like, so I'm still like making myself show up.
Mm-hmm.
And it works. It's like right now, like 2019, I've been really frustrated because I haven't figured out like what I'm excited about creatively to make. And I think 2018 was just so intense that I just sort of like needed a minute. But it's always, and anytime there's a big show, you kind of like drop off this cliff. Usually you get sick because your immune system's low, and you know, and it takes you a minute to recover. And then it's always hard for me to get back into it, because it's sort of like, oh, I've been focused on this thing for so long and working so hard. And so what's next?
Mm-hmm.
And so I've kind of been in that a little bit, and I know that's just part of the cycle. And you know, so I find things to fill my time. Like, I still work on the business, and I'm like, okay, if I'm not super creative right now, then I'll just dump all this energy into something else that's still going to be productive. But yeah, it can just be really challenging. And I think you just still have to go in every day. And it's kind of one of the reasons I'm forcing myself to finish these things lying around the studio that I never got around to.
Yeah. So. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I was in Europe recently, and there's like a prominent European bonsai, the flyby. Yeah. Nobody on the podcast can see that we're basically being inundated by stink bugs again at Mirai. It's thematic and seasonal. But I had the awesome opportunity to talk to one of the pioneers of European bonsai. And when I finished my apprenticeship and started working in Europe, he was fully out of bonsai. He got into Harley Davidsons and was a biker, and my first
different thing.
Yeah, right. like 180 degree difference. And my first interaction with him, I was like so excited to meet him, because I'd been looking at his work and I knew of him and what he had done for so long. And he was such a pivotal figure in Western bonsai in general.
Yeah.
And he was kind of a big dickhead to me.
Really?
Which I was like, all right, well, I guess, you know, like that's who he is or where he's at. And so now he's back in bonsai, like full bore again. And I even told him, I was like, the first time I met you, Danny, you were such an asshole. And he's like, I was totally an asshole to you. And I was like, all right, well, I'm glad we like got that out of the way, you know, and then we were able to like move on.
Yeah.
But he talked about burnout, and he's like, I poured 35 years into it. And I don't know, I just got to a point where I just didn't have it. And he's like, I still showed up, still watered the trees, still kept them alive, like needed to go ride a motorcycle for a while to like process that. But he was like, it was burnout. I just didn't have it anymore. And I've always like wondered that, like, what does that look like? Cause there's like a really weird thing about Japanese culture where burnout doesn't exist because they just don't let it exist. Like Mr. Kimura, my master, has been going like real hard for a long time,
mm-hmm.
you know, 40, 45 years of being on the cutting edge of bonsai in the world. And I don't know if he's ever experienced burnout, but he's never stopped creating cutting edge work. And maybe like his least amount of input is still the highest product that can be made in the art form of bonsai.
Sure, yeah.
But like his highest quality product is untouchable in terms of its creativity and technical mastery. I mean, it's phenomenal, right?
Yeah.
And so having him as this like example of what's possible might not be realistic, because I'm not Japanese. I don't exist in a culture where maybe that's burnout is a thing that they accept.
Right.
But also being in that, it's like, can you mentally overcome the things that are inherently a part of life in another culture and don't exist in that one. And I, and that's been that, that having that time in Japan has plagued me in Bonsai, because one of his first apprentices was an engineer for Toyota at night, an apprentice during the day, and for 6 years of his apprenticeship slept 2 hours maximum a day, and then eventually decided to stop being an engineer at Toyota and apprentice full-time with Mr. Kimura. And is that possible, to will yourself to only sleep 2 hours and be able to survive? Because, like, sleep studies say no, right? So I'm like, am I just, like, really weak in the mentality that I have? Or is that unique to that mindset? Like, I mean, I know the human mind is powerful. There's no doubt it's powerful, right?
Yeah, and the body is capable of so much more than we think.
Yeah.
But you also have a kid.
Oh, for sure. I mean, yeah, and this is, like, at this point in my life with my kid. That, but prior to having my kid, as I'm, like, sitting up here full on, like, reclusing out, and just grinding on Bonsai, I'm thinking about all of these things. Like,
yeah,
am I not, you know, trying hard enough? Am I not driving myself hard enough? How do you break boundaries with, you know, unexplored aspects of a medium? And that stuff is, like, less motivating to me now, and almost in, like, letting go of a lot of that, like, trying to understand and control to some degree. It's a lot easier to just be a lot more free.
Yeah.
With whatever it is we make here. And it's become a hell of a lot more fun, for sure. But also, like, I still, that attachment to Japan, as much as of a gift as it was, really messed me up.
Yeah.
Because you see that difference of approach and work ethic and which one's right, you know, or like, and there's not a, I understand that, but like, but that's possible. Is it possible?
Right.
That's how it's been done. Is that how it should be done? It's just this, like, really difficult push-pull.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Being creative is a labor of love.
Yeah, but also showing up is a discipline.
Yeah, and you have to have both, I think.
Yeah, I was going to say discipline and creativity aren't necessarily, well, I don't think they're at all synonymous.
Mm-mm.
And a lot of the time, they're not even close to compatible.
Yeah, but you have to somehow, like, manage both things at the same time, because you don't really get one well without the other, I don't think.
Well, I mean, isn't this, I mean, when you would go back to saying, like, you have to show up, like, I mean, I think probably that, like, pain and discipline of it's an intangible component of the work. It seems like, I mean, from what you're saying, it's clearly, it's led you to break through a lot of different barriers and accomplish things. And I mean, your work is widely recognized and highly appreciated.
Thank you.
How does that, I mean, that's a product of both the creativity as well as showing up.
Yeah. 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 And I think, you know, the thing that showing up every day, it's allowed me to really break through, like, technical barriers, you know, like, really challenging yourself and then forcing yourself to follow those things through, has really allowed me to get really good at this. And I don't think there's anything else in my life I'm this good at, you know, like, this, I'm really proud of the work I make.
Cool.
Yeah, and I like, I consider myself a fine woodworker and a good craftsman, but, you know, the furniture I make would be okay.
Yeah.
And, like, you know what I mean? It doesn't, like...
Do you make furniture too?
I made myself a drawing table.
Nice.
This year. Yeah. No, I don't. I share a wood shop with a very talented high-end furniture maker.
Mm.
And I've gone through phases where I've helped him with things, but
cool.
Yeah. No, I don't make furniture.
Are there people's work that you look at that inspires you, or, like, that you really enjoy viewing their work, like, specific people?
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of artists. There's not a ton of woodworkers.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't feel like I have a ton of peers in my field. I mean, I know there's people out there, but, like, people that I personally know, Mm-hmm. Which can be hard sometimes. Like all the woodworkers I know are furniture makers. Mm. And so like when you want to hash out this super weird idea and be like, will this work if I make it this way? You have to go through this really intense process of trying to explain what it is first, like to even get them to like grasp,
yeah,
you know, what the idea is. But you know, that's, I would say in college, I learned how to think three-dimensionally, but beyond that, you know, most of my education in woodworking has been post-college.
Yeah.
It's been like myself just, you know, learning on my own and then just like picking people's brains.
Mm.
So.
And most of those people are furniture makers.
And most of them are furniture makers.
Yeah, damn, that's tough.
Yeah.
A little bit of an island.
I mean, I'm not making anything that resembles furniture at all.
Yeah, no, that's full-on sculpture for sure. Huh. And you like, would you say that there are other people who are using wood in a way that is sculptural, that could have some sort of relationship to what you're doing, or is what you're doing, do you feel isolated in terms of what you're doing?
No, I think there's a lot of people doing wood sculptures out there. But I don't know very many of them.
Yeah.
You know, so, I don't have like dialogue with those people.
Yeah.
And I think that would be really nice.
Mm.
You know, like all my artist friends they're painting and they're drawing, or, you know, very few of them are working three-dimensionally even.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's kind of lacking a little bit.
Do you think that seeing other people's sculptural approach to wood would potentially, influence your work or maybe taint it to some degree?
I don't think it would taint it. It might influence me, just seeing different building techniques.
Yeah.
You know, like there's some people out there that are utilizing things more similar to like boat building techniques, like bending wood, skin kayak type techniques,
right.
Which I've always been interested in, but I don't know how to do that.
Yeah.
And things like that really intrigue me because you can work on a large scale without having so much mass. That's the thing I was trying to get away from in the crustaceans that you saw at Skylab, is I was trying to come up with something where it wasn't this big, massive thing that was so heavy.
How much do those weigh?
Oh, not very much. I don't know, 15 pounds.
Oh, really?
20 pounds, maybe.
It's super light.
It varies. Yeah, it's just a plywood skeleton, and then the ribs are veneer.
Hmm.
So... you know, those sort of shell.
Have you seen those, Lime?
I have. I like them a lot, actually.
Yeah.
That's my favorite piece of your work, actually.
Thank you.
Yep. Yeah, I would like to have one of those up here.
Blew my mind.
Thank you.
That kind of skeleton form that you had going there.
Yeah. I would like to have one of those up here for a building that doesn't exist yet, but someday. Someday.
Yeah, you might hit your head on it in this room.
No, it's not going to happen here, that's for sure. No.
We don't need to hit our head on anything else.
No.
You said that and I just kind of like looked around the space and like, I don't know.
Yeah, no.
I think everyone that's worked here has probably knocked themselves out at one point or
another. Yeah. I used to always see that in cartoons, you know, where they like hit their head and knock themselves out. And I was like, that's not real, but it is real. It's real. The most brain trauma I've taken on in my life is definitely in this office. And it has been devastating.
It hurts.
It does. It hurts. It's very, very real.
Especially because we're all used to walking, like, looking at our phones now. So.
That's a no-go up here. Like, between the table, basically, I mean, you've got, like, a reaper's claw hanging out to... I mean, it really made Berg bleed pretty bad today. It was... he was trying to get a phone call, and he ducked to miss that and just... I mean, came up and caught the full like blade of that redwood piece. I felt really bad for it because I'm the one who set this room up like this. So I do feel like a lot of responsibility for when people totally mess themselves up. I'm like, that's kind of on me. I'm sorry. But yeah, this seems to still be the most efficient use of the space, because really this table doesn't fit in it, but I don't have anywhere else to put it. So it is what it is. Like,
yeah,
you got to dance around it.
Yeah.
Laura, it's been super cool to sit with you tonight.
Yeah, thank you.
And
thanks,
it's really,
for having me.
I'm super excited to have your pieces at Mirai.
Thank you. I'm excited they're here.
You get to enjoy them.
I didn't know about Mirai before this, so I'm thankful.
Yeah. 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 A little glimpse into Tiny Trees.
Yeah.
I wish you the best of luck in everything that you're doing, and I'm excited to keep seeing where you choose to go with it.
Thank you. Yeah.
Got big fans up here.
Thank you.
Cool. Well, have a safe drive home.
Thank you.
All right.